This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I am Jamie Jackson, the producer of this episode. We join with hundreds of organizations around the world to commemorate the 74th anniversary of the Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe that Palestinians have given to the mass expulsion of Palestinian Arabs from British Mandate Palestine during Israel's creation from 1947 to 1949. In 1948, Zionist Jews owned only about 7% of the private land in Palestine and made up only about 33% of the population. And yet, when the United Nations partitioned the land, it gave 55% of the land to the proposed Jewish state. Israel declared independent. The large-scale expulsions of Palestinians began, and almost immediately violence broke out, long before the armies of neighboring Arab states became involved. This was the onset of the Nakba. The Nakba has continued from 1948 through today in the form of Israel's ongoing theft of Palestinian land for settlements and for Jewish communities inside Israel, its destruction of Palestinian homes and agricultural land, revocation of residency rights, deportations, periodic brutal military assaults that result in mass civilian casualties, and the denial of the internationally recognized legal right of return of millions of stateless Palestinian refugees. On May 7, I spoke with Jonathan Ophir, Israeli musician, conductor, blogger, and writer. Jonathan talked about Tantura, a recent documentary that chronicles the 1948 massacre of Palestinian civilians in the village of Tantura during the Nakba. More than 50 years after the massacre, a firestorm erupted among Israelis following media exposure of the master's thesis that lies at the core of this story. Jonathan grew up with Teddy Katz, the academic whose career was sabotaged over his master's thesis. The documentary Tantura is currently included in the 2022 Sundance Film Festival. Jonathan Ophir, welcome to Understanding Israel-Palestine. Perhaps you could start by giving us an overview of the Tantura story.
Teddy Katz, I happen to know him personally quite well from my childhood because I come from a kibbutz, very close to his kibbutz. I studied with his daughter and so on. But I never heard about the Tantura story before, you know, more recent years when I was researching more thoroughly, like Nakba issues, especially massacres. Tantura was actually the second largest, apparently, of the massacres in 1948, talking probably about 250 massacred civilians there. Well, the story has several layers, which this film Tantura, it hasn't been available for me, even though I know what's in that film. And I haven't managed to see the whole film yet, but I know the story very well. Teddy Katz, he did his masteral thesis in 1998 for masters at the Haifa University. His theme was several coastal villages, which were, he didn't even use the term massacre, several operations of Israeli or Zionist militias in 1948 in coastal towns in that area, and Tantura was one of them. And this didn't cause any significant uproar or attention at the time. He interviewed 60 hours of tape with, basically the idea was interviewing, putting an emphasis on oral interviews and interviewing about 20 of those who were the perpetrators, like from the Zionist Haganah Alexandroni militia, and about 20 of the survivors, which were ethnically cleansed from Tantura. And he put it together into this kind of big work with lots of citations, which basically left no doubt to the fact of horrific grand massacre, although he didn't even use the word at that point. And it just stood on a shelf in the library in Haifa until some journalist in Ma'ariv, an Israeli mainstream newspaper, in 2000 picked it up, looked at it, and he wrote about it. And then he used the word massacre, and looks like this is a massacre. And then these people, the veterans of the Alexandrani Brigade, they have this, you know, they have this kind of society, and they went bananas about it because it was, they were okay. Apparently he won their trust when he interviewed them, and they were okay telling about what they were doing. You know, there was this guy, he pulled a few guys out to the side and he shot them in a row, and then he took another group and so on. And even one of the people who got to the highest rank of general from those veterans, Ambar, Shlomo Ambar, he told him horrific things, which he himself had reflected. He was like reflecting back about the Nazis, and that even comparing the Nazis favorably to what they did. He was saying, oh, well, Nazis usually didn't kill the prisoners of war. And he was reflecting like very badly about what they were doing. And then when this all came out to the public in 2000, then they went bananas about it. Then they went ballistic and they sued him for libel. So they had to, the way they did it is basically took those tapes. Ilan Pape, the Israeli historian, says, Teddy did not have to deliver those tapes to them for scrutiny, but he did. They got all the hours of interviews, and they went through them, like they combed it through, and they checked whether there was certain discrepancies between what he wrote and what they said. You know, they found, I think, six small examples, like, you know, like the one with Shlomo Ambar. He said Germans, and Teddy Katz wrote Nazis, and some, you know, pretty silly things. And they went with that and said he misrepresented, you know, what was said. These were very small discrepancies. Teddy was telling me that he interviewed some of these people, some victims in Arabic, and it was outside, and he had to have a translator, and they had to go through this. Sometimes it was unclear what was said. So, you know, they managed to catch from these 60 hours, they managed to catch these few examples, and then they went with it, no libel. What is kind of striking is that in that the court meeting, they caught him, this whole thing caught Teddy Katz very badly in his personal life. He was already in a bad, very bad physical condition. He had a actually heart stroke at that point, and his family wanted him to stop, and he was losing money on it. His car got pounded, and he was looking at the possibility of an extended trial that could, you know, cost him his life somehow. So he kind of, at a moment of weakness, he kind of went back and signed some document to get out of it without his actual official lawyer. He was only with his cousin, who's a lawyer, but it wasn't his main lawyer. And he regretted it deeply. He tells me, like, he couldn't sleep that night, and then he woke up and went to his lawyer, and he said, no, I'm really regretting this. I want to continue with this case. But the judge, she said, oh, it's a signed deal. It looks like I have no reason to, you know, to challenge this. And the Alexandrani veterans, they were victorious. They put up an ad in the papers and said, this shows that it was just a blood libel against us, and we're heroes and all that. But what is striking is, and I know this, that this is in the film, that you know, the filmmaker, Schwartz, Alon Schwartz, he plays some of those, you know, testimonies to the judge, who apparently never looked into the details of what he actually researched. And he just looked, it was just like a first meeting, and he signed this thing, and she went, I'm not going into the details of this at all. If he signed this, I'm not going back. It doesn't matter if he regrets it. But now that she's in the film, she listens to it, and she goes, well, if you know, if he had that, then it seems to me that he should have gone all the way with it. So, and that was actually her responsibility to sort of go and check out, like, what is it that they're actually talking about, and what was in there. But she didn't. And she's now saying, like, he should have gone all the way if he had that. Yeah, he wanted to go all the way, and he kind of fell in that moment of weakness. So from 2000, you know, in from that time for two decades, once again, a truth of that massacre has been buried cognitively in the public perception. And this massacre was not only cognitively buried, it was physically buried. And the film documents by aerial photographs and so on, a mass grave. I recall we are talking about some 34 meter, I can't remember the exact size, but 35 times, can't remember how much. It's a big mass grave. And it's located under the parking lot of this kibbutz, of this beach near the kibbutz Nachsholim. It's a very, very popular place. And that mass grave is just there in the parking lot. It was known about, some people knew that it was somewhere there, but now in the film, they apparently managed to find the location of it more precisely.
Well, I know you're still talking about it, and Ilan Pappe is still talking about it, and for that matter, Teddy Katz is still talking about it. But is it in the public domain at all? I mean, is it getting into mainstream media, or is it managed to be buried pretty much?
No, I think that the film might, by what I'm reading in the media about the film, it seems to have broken that conspiracy of silence or that doubt about it. If, by what I see, it's now no longer really a discussion. Was there a massacre? Was there a mass grave? Was there not? And so on. It's more like, okay, this happened. Now, what does that mean? There will always be, you know, the deniers and they will nitpick at this and that detail. But I think it kind of broke through that. Now maybe people are going to go, it's a one-off, but you know, that's also, it's not a one-off. It's one of many similar events. And that mass grave, it's not like we really had to wait for that film to indicate, oh, here is the mass grave. I mean, there are testimonies, and they are in Teddy Katz's work, from some guides from Zichron Yaakov, a Jewish settlement that is now a kind of city. They came there, and they accompanied the Alexandrani brigade. One of those guides, he testified that he counted about 230 bodies in that mass grave. He also came after several days, and it was actually bloated because of the heat from the sun. It's like there have been credible testimonies, and it's almost impossible to understand that people thought that was just an invention. But maybe a lot of people wanted to think that way, because once you start, you know, digging in that history.
Well, my impression is that if the Israeli public, the media, acknowledges that this happened, that it's dismissed as, well, this is what happens in war.
Yeah.
Although we can make it clear that it did happen after Israel had already declared independence. So this was the Israeli army, the soldiers that committed these crimes.
Yeah. This is not completely linear, because you're right. I mean, this massacre happened around 22nd, 23rd of May, which is after May 15th, you know, the point where Israel is self-declared. And yet it took some time, because this Alexandrani brigade, the Haganah, it was this kind of militia, Jewish militant force. This one was like the mainstream one under Ben-Gurion. There were others there, like the Irgun and the Stern Gang, you know, other militias. And it took some months for this all to be incorporated together and put together into the what's called the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces. So officially, it's still kind of like this transition period. But that doesn't really matter. In terms of the war, yeah, you can say that the 1948 war that Israelis called the War of Independence. Yeah, officially it started as Israel declared itself on May 15th. So you could say, okay, it happened within the war, but that doesn't really matter because if you look at earlier massacres, let's say, for example, the Deir Yassin massacre on April 9th that year, that was long before the state was declared. There was a whole chain of ethnic cleansings in Haifa and Jaffa and so on that were already taking place in the spring before Israel was declaring itself. So this is the big historical discussion, you know, about whether these things happened as a result of war or whether they were designed. Benny Morris, for example, he sees these things, what he calls transfer, what I call and what Ilan Pape would call ethnic cleansing. He calls it transfer, and he says it was caused by war, not by design. On the other hand, he sort of reveals what was really behind it, because he himself kind of turned around and said, well, you know, we should have, at some point he said, we should have, Ben-Gurion should have done finished the job, like a bigger ethnic cleansing and finished off everything so that he would cause peace for generations. He actually talks like that.
For those of you who may just be tuning in, this is Understanding Israel-Palestine, and we are listening to my interview with Jonathan Ophir about the recent documentary Tantura. Says that they should have transferred all the Arabs out of.
Yeah, and then we would have no one to have a conflict with, right? Yeah, but the question of war, we have to ask another question for those people who say that's just, you know, what happens in war. If that's just what happens in war, why can't we, 74 years later, look that in the eye? Because millions of pages of these documents from 1948 are still censored. Israel is not being open about what actually happened there. And Israel is reclassifying, declassified documents on that period. It's like there is a conspiracy of silence about it because it doesn't look good. And the question is, if it was only then and if it was only war at that time and that's what happened, you know, why can't we look at it? And my obvious answer to that is that it's not really finished. It's not born from war. What happened then was not born from war per se, and it was a design that keeps on happening. I mean, just the other day, 2 days ago, the Israeli Supreme Court actually approved the removal of about a thousand Palestinians from the Masafer Yatta area, which is an occupied West Bank, citing, you know, military zone. It's a military zone. They have to be there. It's against international law. These things continue to happen. Israel continues to expand. They knew it also at the time. So when a bigger massacre occurred, for example, in October that year in 1948, and this is the Dawaime massacre, and here we're talking about probably around 400 or 500 civilians, then, you know, there were descriptions of things, you know, they got to the government, there were government discussions, they were describing things that they called, like, you know, Nazi acts, like, you know, killing children with clubs, hitting them on the head with clubs. And, you know, there's lots of descriptions. Someone firing in Ramleh, someone firing a missile into a mosque and killing a few hundred civilians. And it's like there's been a cover-up of those things because it looked bad for Israelis themselves.
Well, let me ask you a question. Because I have not seen the film yet, the Tatura film, but I did listen to an interview of Alan Schwartz. I was surprised, I shouldn't have been, but I was surprised that despite what he uncovered and told the story of, he still is an ardent Zionist.
Yeah, well, I think there's, a difference between looking at one event, or maybe one or two events, and saying like that this is a terrible thing, but it's an aberration, and looking at that as part of a grand pattern that has been instrumental for Zionism.
I wonder if he sees it as an aberration or it's just something that needs to be done in order for the Jewish state to survive.
I don't know if he would say that had to be done. I find that difficult to believe, but you know, we can relate to massacres and still, you know, believe in the state and think it was a few people and that was bad, but not all the rest of it. I mean, there's another pundit, Ari Shavit. He was kind of disgraced due to sexual harassment case, but you know, he was very famous also in the US with his book My Promised Land. He was a journalist for Haaretz, and he went around talking about it, and he wrote about the Ramle and Lida, what is called today Ramle and Lod, the ethnic cleansings there. That's one case, by the way, that we have a signature for expulsion. It's actually signed by Yitzhak Rabin as a commander. And in a classified document that came out in the New York Times, I think in the 90s, Rabin said that he actually asked Ben-Gurion what should be done with the people here. And Ben-Gurion, he says, like waved with his hand, like waved them off. And that was enough. They had these signs. They didn't need many words, and he signed. So we have that signature from Rabin. So Ari Shavit, he related to that expulsion, and finally he goes like, yeah, that was an ethnic cleansing. He actually calls it ethnic cleansing, but he says it was a mini ethnic cleansing. A mini, yeah, it was a little ethnic cleansing. Never mind, it was like 50,000 people. Okay, it was a mini ethnic cleansing. He said, but anyway. If he had to choose between, you know, between Ramla and Zionism, he chooses Zionism. You know, there's this logic with it that, you know, we might have done these really bad things, but actually we somehow know that we had to do it in some way. Maybe it should have been less ugly, maybe, you know, maybe whatever, but we had to do these things. And why did we have to do these things? Somehow we all know why we had to do these things. And Benny Morris, whom I mentioned before, he has the explanation in his book, The Palestinian Refugee Problem Revisited. I think that's a 2004 edition. He says transfer was inbuilt in Zionism. And it was inbuilt and inevitable because Zionism sought to create a Jewish state, and Jewish state could not be formed in a place which was predominantly Arab without transfer of the Arab population. So that it's a pretty crystal clear logic. And I think every Zionist understands it. And why I'm saying I think everyone Zionist understands it, because if there's one thing that unites Zionists pretty much across the board, you know, from the liberal to the hardcore, it's that the right of return of Palestinian refugees from that mass Nakba wave. And there was also other waves in 1967 and smaller waves, as even we see today, that the right of return is simply a no-no. We can't talk about it. Nowadays, it's something like not one refugee, like Tzipi Livni, the centrist negotiator, said in 2008, not one refugee. They used to talk about some symbolic numbers and so on. It's a consensus. And they're trying to make it an activist.
It's consensus on the Israeli side, but the holding on to the right of return is growing among Palestinians, I think.
Absolutely. That's the one issue that will unite Palestinians like no other. You're right. When I say it's a consensus, it's a Zionist consensus, and it's also a Palestinian consensus, and they're diametrically opposed. Why are they diametrically opposed? Because one side tried to implemented by ethnically cleansing the other, and it's still not allowing return because it doesn't want to reverse the result. That's the whole, for me, that's the whole logic of it. That's the price of Jewish state.
I think people are just wrestling with what the solution is. And as you say, the Israelis, even the liberal, quote, liberal Zionists, are firmly on one side against allowing the refugees back in. Yeah. Well, is there anything else you would like to tell us about before we end? What is memoricide? Memoricide. I thought it was a great word myself, memoricide. Kill off your memory when you need to.
Yeah, no, I don't know if it's something I coined or I remember that someone else wrote. So sometimes I find funny words, right. Invent funny words. But anyway, it totally does resonate with me. I mean, This is what we're talking about when we're talking about Stentura. It's like something happened. Someone brings those memories to the fore, you know, records them, puts them in hundreds of pages. And then, because you know what happened when the Alexandrani Brigade, that article came out in 2000, and suddenly it was public, they signed, this Shlomo Ambar I mentioned, he was the one who initiated this affidavit system. They signed affidavits that they simply do not remember anything that they told Teddy Katzen is on tape. They don't remember what they just remembered.
Well, that happened in the States earlier. Too. I don't have to tell you all the stories that happened.
And I mean, isn't that memory side? Like, oh, I remembered it, but now I forgot that I don't remember that I remembered it.
Well, thank you very much. I know there's going to be quite a number of events around Nakba. I'm looking forward to everybody standing up for Palestinians.
You have been listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine, a weekly program that presents news and opinions from academics, journalists, activists, and other experts on issues about Israel and Palestine, which are frequently disregarded by the mainstream media. You can access many of our episodes at www.kkfi.org. In this episode, we heard my interview with Jonathan Ophir, Israeli musician, conductor, blogger, and writer. Jonathan talked about a recent documentary that chronicles the 1948 massacre of Palestinian civilians in the village of Tantura and the firestorm that erupted among Israelis more than 50 years later following media exposure. The documentary Tantura is currently included in the 2022 Sundance Film Festival. Social justice organizations across the globe use many avenues to educate us about the Nakba and the military occupation of Palestine. In mid-May, hundreds of rallies are being organized in support of the Palestinian struggle to stop the Nakba and end the military occupation. Rallies across virtually every country in Europe, but also in South Africa, Australia, Canada, and the United States. One way to see a list of these rallies is to use the search words Nakba and Samadun. That's Samidoun. Art and the continued production of cultural artifacts is an important avenue of resistance embraced by Palestinians. In May, Voices from the Holy Land is featuring three films about Palestinian art as resistance. To receive a link to the films, and then join an online panel discussion on May 15th, go to www.voicesfromtheholyland.org.